Hello, and welcome to the Project Good podcast. I'm your host, Anne-Marie Hilton. Project Good is a social impact podcast interviewing experts and advocates about the pressing problems that we face globally and hearing how they suggest we move forward in the future. The Project Good podcast is brought to you by Project Good Work. The goal of this podcast is to inspire people and organizations to develop a mindset that can move others to positive action regarding the complex social issues facing people and the planet. For March, we're focusing on protecting our future. Child sexual abuse is a deeply concerning issue that has significant implications for the well-being of individuals and societies worldwide. The prevalence of child sexual abuse varies across regions and populations. According to the World Health Organization, or WHO, globally, an estimated 18% of girls and 8% of boys experience sexual abuse before the age of 18. Child sexual abuse is often underreported due to various factors, including fear, shame, stigma, and lack of awareness or trust in support systems. It is believed that many cases go unreported, making it challenging to accurately gauge the full extent of the problem. Child sexual abuse can have profound and lasting effects on the mental health and well-being of survivors. Survivors may experience a range of psychological consequences, including post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and difficulties forming healthy relationships. Certain factors may increase the risks of child sexual abuse, including family dysfunction, substance abuse within the family, poverty, exposure to violence, and lack of protective factors such as strong social networks. Perpetrators of child sexual abuse can be individuals known to the child, such as family members, relatives, caregivers, or trusted adults, as well as strangers. Perpetrators may use coercion, manipulation, threats, or physical force to exploit and victimize children. Advocate and speaker and author Joelle Kastix knows the statistics and experience all too well. She is a leading global expert, author, and keynote speaker of survivors of child sexual assault and institutional cover-up. With more than two decades of strategic communication, she's an expert in child sexual prevention, digital accountability, social media safety, and international online privacy issues. Since going public in 2002 as a survivor of child sexual abuse, Kastix has devoted her career to exposing abuse, advocating on behalf of survivors, and spreading abuse prevention strategies for parents and communities. She's a regular speaker for the National Center for Victims of Crime, the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma, the Survivors Networks, and those abused by priests. She runs the Worthy Adversary blog, which provides information and commentary on child sexual abuse prevention and exposure, and is the host of two podcasts, the Unmasked podcast and the Spot the Lying podcast. Let's get into the interview. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Joelle Kastix, who is in the trenches and has an approach who has helped bring awareness to the scope and scale of the global crisis of child sexual abuse and the profound effects of this crime on victims and their communities. She's an expert in dealing with institutions such as the Roman Catholic Church, public schools, and organizations that cover up and enable child sexual assault, the role of parents playing prevention, and how to eradicate and end the cycle through emerging technology and strong victim-friendly legislation. In addition, she's the author of several books, The Well-Armored Child, A Parent's Guide to Preventing Sexual Abuse, The Power of Responsibility, Six Decisions That Will Help You Take Back Happiness and Create Unlimited Success, The Compassionate Response, How to Help and Empower Adult Victims and Child Sexual Abuse. Welcome, Joelle.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for being there in this long intro. And sorry, today I have a little bit of a frog in my throat. So excuse me a little bit if I clear my throat sometimes.
No problem.
So before we get into the questions, I always like to find out a little bit about the person that I'm interviewing from a personal standpoint. So I thought I would give you kind of I hope it's a fun question. To me, it's a fun question because I always like to think about these things. But what would you say is one of your big goals for 2024?
Oh, I want to learn how to do a handstand.
Oh, Okay, that's a different one.
It's funny because I was just thinking about that the other day. When I grew up, my parents were not into athletics. We never did gymnastics or anything like that. And I'm 53 years old, and I'm like, I got to learn how to do a handstand. And it's one of those things that you can't just like throw yourself up against a wall and do it. It's very much an incremental thing. I had to strengthen certain parts of my shoulders and everything else. So it'll probably take me the whole year to figure out how to do it. But it's very similar to how I tackle all kinds of projects. There's a great result with a whole lot of work, you know, beforehand that no one really sees.
Okay, wow. That's amazing because, you know, as, you know, not that, you know, I'm not too far behind you age-wise, but as we get older, you know, working on your strength is so important for your overall health, especially for women. I guess statistically, I guess we lose strength a little bit faster than men. So that's fantastic that you're working to like build yourself up to do a handstand, because I know that takes like a lot of core strength and things like that. So congratulations, and I'm sure you'll take some photos once you get to that point.
yes, definitely.
So I'm so excited to speak with you because of your expertise, and also because this is an important topic. And I thought it was a great topic actually for March, being that March is Women's Month, and that, you know, not that men and boys haven't experienced this, but the statistics show that women tend to be victimized a lot more with child sexual abuse and assault than men do. So this is an important topic. And of course, as a society, as we're getting, you know, more and more into, I guess you would say, the digital landscape, we're getting lost in these virtual worlds, protecting our children is becoming more and more important. So I guess let's start, I guess, for the beginning. I guess, do you want to tell a little bit about your story for those who are not, I guess, familiar with you?
Okay. So my name is Jamila Castex, and I was born and raised in Southern California. And for the past 20 years, I've been an advocate and spokesperson and writer and lobbyist on behalf of issues facing childhood sexual abuse survivors, because I was one. I am one. And I found myself in a unique position that because I had come to a certain point in my healing and I had certain skills, that I was able to assume this kind of role because when you help others, you help yourself. So it's also a huge part of my own healing. So yeah, I'm from Southern California, Orange County, not Real Housewives. And I came from a family where I was very, very vulnerable. My mother was an alcoholic and my dad was in big denial. And I was just kind of, it was assumed that I would just suck it up and deal with it, but I didn't. I had horrible depression, suicidal ideations. And when I was 15, I attempted suicide and spent 3 or 4 months in a psychiatric hospital after that. But the one thing that kept me going through all this was the fact that I was a singer. I was in the elite touring choir at my high school, Modern Day High School. I was being coached to go into classical singing as a career. It was a place where I had really like found my footing. And so I loved being in the choir. And so the beginning of my junior year, we got a new choir director, and he was young, and he was bright, and he was talented, and he was charismatic, and he was good looking, and he was magnetic, and the kids loved him. And he loved his job because it gave him access to girls. And it didn't take long before he targeted me. You were talking in the intro about how children are manipulated into child sexual abuse, and very little child sexual abuse is done under force or coercion. It's the majority is manipulation, and it's done through a process called predatory grooming, where the predator tricks the kid into thinking child sexual abuse is okay. Through flattery, gifts, blurring sexual boundaries, just really making the child feel special, isolating them from their peers and family. And it serves a dual purpose. One, it makes a compliant victim who's not likely to speak up, and it keeps the victim quiet for a long time. And so that's what this the perpetrator did to me. You know, so now I understand that your mom's an alcoholic. My dad's an alcoholic too. No one gets you like I do. No one understands you. And it was very easy for me to be manipulated into the full-on abuse. And for many of these predators, and I believe the man who abused me as well, it's not about the sex, it's about the power. It's about the conquest. It's about having power over these girls who care about him. Because when you think about survivors of childhood sexual abuse, the reason that they're so easily abused is because they love the person who abused them. If you're abused by your parents, you love that person. And so you're in this totally conflicted world. If you're abused by your grandfather, but you still love your grandfather. And it's the same thing when in these situations with priests and teachers. You know, the reason that he got such good access is because we all loved him. So I was abused over a two-year period. And during that time, the school knew about the abuse. I came forward and told them, and they told me that this is what love was and I should be quiet. Otherwise, I'll end up back in the psychiatric institution. And so I stayed quiet, and my peers found out and blamed me for it. And by the time I graduated, I was pregnant and had a sexually transmitted disease, and I had no support. So, you know, it was a really rough time, and I muddled my way through college, made it through, but it was very self-destructive, huge suicidal ideations, very, you know, doing things that I knew weren't good for me. And so finally, in my mid to late 20s, I had been married and divorced. I was broke. I, you know, was not living up to any of the potential I had. I was quitting jobs or being self-destructive on jobs. And I finally looked at myself and said, you know, I'm at a crossroads here. I can continue on the path that I'm on and probably end up dead. Or I can really focus on my healing and change stuff. And I decided to take responsibility, not for what happened to me, but for how I live my life from that day forward. And so that's the objective. That's been my goal all along. And so, you know, I got my act together. I realized that the only person who could make my life better was me, and that I could take what happened to me and turn it into a launching pad to better myself every single day, or I could turn it into an anchor so it would drag me down into an early grave. And I said no way to that. So in 2002, the state of California opened up a one-year civil window for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. And the importance of the civil window is that while it doesn't put a predator behind bars, it exposes everyone who covered up the abuse. And in my case, it was the Catholic high school and the Catholic diocese and all the people who worked there. They knew I was being abused and they did nothing. And they knew he went on to abuse other girls and they did nothing. So I came forward and I filed a lawsuit. And through that, I became a primary spokesperson for a lot of survivors. And in 2005, my case settled and I got more than 200 pages of documents that showed the extent of the widespread cover-up of child sexual abuse, not just in my case, but throughout the school. And I got a lot of dignity back in that and decided that everyone should be able to have the opportunity to find that dignity. And so I've devoted my career since. I testify in front of state legislatures to change laws to allow civil windows other places. I lobby for victim-friendly legislation. I've written books about child protection and how parents can help protect their kids and how people can work better with survivors who are just initially coming forward. I did a TED Talk a while back about the role of responsibility in the lives of survivors. And now I just really devote my time to getting the word out and continuing the conversation, because the more we talk openly about child sexual abuse, the less vulnerable our children are, because it won't be shrouded in shame and secrecy. If at the high school I attended, they had just said, if a teacher kisses a student, that is child sexual abuse. I wouldn't have been abused, and or it would have stopped a lot earlier, and the school wouldn't have been a den of abuse, because there's something like 13 predators at that school during the time I was there. So yeah, and it's been a wild ride. I never thought I would end up here, but it's nice to wake up in the morning and be like, okay, you know, if something were to happen to me tomorrow, I at least did something good for someone else. Maybe I stopped this from happening to another child. And so, yeah, so I've been married now for about 20 years, and my son is 17 and a senior in high school. And, you know, I just, every day there's something new coming up that people need help with, whether it's the Boy Scouts and their quagmire of child sexual abuse, or the Southern Baptist Convention and their quagmire, or what's going on in the music industry right now, or the aftermath of Me Too. There's always someone who needs help and a voice, and if they need my help and want it, I'm there to give it to them.
Yes, I was actually going to, you lead to the perfect question. I guess, why do you think there's like this, we could say, how do you think modern culture has perpetuated this increase in sexual abuse? Or I guess, was it always there, and it's just being that people are becoming brave now? Do you think there's like an increase because of how our culture has changed, or was it always like that?
You know, there are a lot of differing opinions on this, but I have a theory, and my theory is that abuse has not gone up, but people are more willing to talk about it. I look back even to when I was a young professional, and the kind of sexual harassment I had to deal with and just suck it down, none of which would be tolerated today. That doesn't mean that there's more sexual harassment today. It just means that we have come to an enlightenment in our society that women should never be treated that way. And, you know, the next milestone, there's a big scandal right now in the music industry about young female musicians being, and women who follow the bands being sexually assaulted by band members and stuff. And this has been going on for years and years and years. And it's the first reaction everyone has is, oh, well, they were groupies and it's the casting couch. And if you want to make it up, you have to, you know, sleep with certain people. And we need to put aside those notions because it's a power thing. Men do not have to sleep their way to the top. Why do women? And it's as other women sleep their way to the top, they're manipulated and coerced into it. And so I think that our children are far more informed. My son knew what sexual abuse was. He knew the biological names of all of his body parts. He was not an easy target for a predator. More and more of our children are not easy targets for predators. So my son, if he encounters or suspects abuse, will be more likely to report because we've talked about it. We've said, hey, you know, if you see anything, it's okay to come and talk to me. That didn't happen in the era that I grew up. In the 70s, it was the kid's fault. In the 80s, it was the kid's fault. My parents blamed me for my abuse. And so I think that as a society, in Western society in the United States, we've really made huge strides in giving women back their power against sexual assault and children against child sexual abuse. We have a long way to go, but the more and more we focus on the fact that it has nothing to do with sex and everything to do with power and domination, I think the more we will be able to fight these kinds of assaults in a way that is effective and empowers survivors and empowers children to make sure that they are empowered against it.
Yes. And so, you have, I would say, the perfect books to guide parents. I guess how do you become, because I'm assuming that a lot of parents may not be comfortable talking with their child about this topic. And so what would you say would be your three top pointers to get parents comfortable with talking with their child about this child abuse?
Well, the first thing to remember is that talking about and educating your child against child sexual abuse does not need to involve any discussion of sex, sexuality, any of that. That's not involved. And so that when people hear that, they're like, oh, good, I don't have to do talk about the birds and the bees or talk about sex. No, it's because there are so many things that you can do to protect and empower your children and never broach the subject of sex. So one of the things that I really like to do is work with parents of preschoolers because they are so open to suggestions and help, and their kids haven't really gotten sucked into smartphones yet. And what I tell them is that there are simple things that you can do, and you can do this even if your kids are older. Number one, teach your children the proper biological names of their body parts. The number one way that predators get access to very small children are children who do not know the proper names of their body parts or give them pet names. And I'll give you a story. So I worked with a survivor, and she was sexually abused by her grandfather. And she was told to call her vagina Ahaha because the mother was scared to say the word vagina or just embarrassed, you know. And so the grandfather came over and he was tickling her, and his hand deliberately went down to her crotch. And she said, oh, you touched my ha-ha. And he said, your ha-ha, I like to laugh. Can I touch it again? And because her biological parts weren't given the gravitas of their biological name, of course she said, well, I guess so, because she didn't know. You know, we call our kidney a kidney because it's a very important organ with very important functions. So we need to call our vagina a vagina because it's a very important organ with very important functions. And when children understand that, they know that people aren't supposed to touch them there because you tell them the next step is, you say, you know, does anyone else touch your penis or your vagina? No. Does anyone take pictures? No. Do you take pictures of anyone else's? No. And this doesn't have to be a questioning. For us, it was a game in the bathtub. Hey, does anyone touch your penis? No. Yeah. Does anyone take pictures? No. And so it was very easy to make it a casual, fun conversation that wasn't weird. And so another big thing I tell parents is to really discuss the difference between secrets and surprises. This is especially important in middle school when kids really start to disclose the fact that they're abused. And the first thing they do is they disclose to their friend and they swear that poor little friend to secrecy. So now that little friend has to carry that pain and shame too. And so what I encourage parents to do is tell their kids, you know, some things should never be secret. And this is one of them. If you have a friend who's being hurt, you know that you can come to me safely and we will get that person help. And you can tell that friend, you've told me and you don't have to suffer through this alone, and we will get you help and make sure you're safe. And the reason I bring in surprises is because when the kids are little, you want to make sure that you tell them, you know, a secret is something that someone never wants you to tell. A surprise is something that you will find out at a certain time, like what's in your birthday present or what's under the Christmas tree or a surprise party or stuff like that. So you don't have your kid accidentally giving away all the Christmas, you know, spoiling all the surprises. And so those are simple things you can do. And then as your kid gets older, tell them how to report, you know, and make sure that every kid has 3 or 4 trusted adults in their lives that they can go to talk about things that are uncomfortable. For example, you know, my son, he can come to me because I'm safe. He knows I'll react appropriately. I won't fly off the handle. His dad may or may not be on that list, not because his dad is unsafe, but his dad, you know, may not give him the reaction that he feels safe with. Sometimes he gets upset and flies off the handle, not in any, just, you know, the way that certain people do. And then we have a neighbor that is a trusted adult that Nick knows that he can go to and really talk to. And every kid needs about 3 or 4 of those people that they know and trust, that just in case, let's say I'm not home and my husband's not home and the neighbor's not home. And so he can go to Peggy down the street and be like, Peggy, something really bad happened. I need your help. And when you give a kid that safety net, then they won't have to suffer through these things on their own. And you're keeping them safer from all kinds of predation and all kinds of problems, not just sexual abuse. And so these are very simple things. And not once did I talk about the birds and the bees. Not once did I talk about sex. Not once was there any kind of moral equation on it. Because, you know, I went to Catholic school. So, you know, sex was before you're married was a sin. So we just, we only talk about the biological aspect, and any other of it that you do is sinful. So me being sexually abused, I guess, was extrapolated in my mind as me sinning. And that's not how you protect kids from abuse. That's how you make your kids easy targets. And I refuse to let that continue.
I love that you have like three simple things and things that I actually didn't think about, you know, essentially creating a community for your child to be comfortable talking about, you know, if abuse, or sexual abuse happened to them. You know, that's the one thing I actually haven't heard before is creating a comfortable community that they could go out, because I'm always just thinking, you know, talk to a family member. But of course, you know, if the family member is the perpetrator, that's problematic, right?
Yes.
Yes, that's wonderful. And plus, you know, it is, it's important that, you know, just as a society, I guess, that we start getting comfortable with these types of things. And one of the biggest things now, once we entered this, you know, digital age of like social media, and social media, of course, has been under the microscope in the last few years for a variety of different reasons and things. But one of the, you know, areas that I think was not thought about until, you know, children got more and more involved in social media is how predators and you know, get direct access to children. So I know that you are currently working on some online projects. I think you are part of, if I am correct still, that you're still part of Project G and working. Oh, go ahead.
Actually, no. Project G has been shelved. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I have other stuff I can talk about along that line.
Okay, that would be okay. Well, I guess I thought it was important. I know you were working on the digital aspects of protecting children online. So I guess, would you like to dive in on how parents, because as you know, if you've seen it, you know, it's been brought to Senate, social media is, you know, under attack. So how can parents, you know, get control of this type of new medium that every kid is just jumping on? So how do we take control?
Well, first, I think the most important part is to understand that these social media platforms are built to be addictive. TikTok was an algorithm that was built to be addictive before they realized that if they put user-generated content on it, it would you know, that's how, that was the content for it. Instagram is made to be addictive. It's made to keep you on. Facebook the same, not as much. And so when we see kids on this, I mean, and we'll notice that, you know, you try to get your kids' attention and you have about 60 seconds. But a kid glued to a screen is rapt. They are focused and in. And what that does is it, first of all, you have the kids 100% focus. And then if they are in their room on their phone, where does a kid feel safest? In their room, on their phone. I mean, for parents out there, there's that time right before a kid goes to bed where they're laying in bed and you're putting them into bed, and they're now telling you like everything that happened during the day. And you know that they're mostly just stalling so they don't have to go to sleep, but you learn a lot during those times. And that's where predators are when a kid is on a phone at night. They have that opportunity to hear all your child's secrets. And so if we understand that our child's biology, these platforms were tailor-made to cater to our child's biology, then we can sit back and say, you know, all of our good words aren't going to help. It really comes to limiting time. It comes to monitoring their usage. It comes to not allowing children on social media under 13 at all. It comes to talking to your children about what they see on social media. There's also another issue involved, which is there's been a lot of development of internet-based cults because, I normally am not good at predicting trends, but I kind of knew that cults would move online and they'd become extraordinarily powerful because I saw that power of the online community and the power of that groupthink. And so it really is, parents have to take a very active role in what their children do. And this is also where that community comes into play, because you may not see every single thing your child posts, but the other important adults in that child's life may. And they will report back to you. And you tell your kid, you know, people are looking. My friends are looking. So we will make sure that you are safe. It's also, you know, basic rules and skills with every kid. Don't talk to strangers on the internet. Especially if someone says that they are a 13-year-old girl, and or if, you know, say for a high school boy, if they're a 16-year-old girl and they think he's really cute and they would love to see a picture of him naked, that's not a 16-year-old girl. It's usually a 40-year-old dude living in his mom's basement. If you don't know this person, if you've never met this person in real life, do not exchange information with them on the internet. When people are an adult, they can do what they want, but for children, no way. I worked with a bunch of kids who were sucked in via YouTube, and they were told that this girl was a friend of Taylor Swift, and she could get them into the Taylor Swift concert, and she could get them free T-shirts, but the girls had to send pictures of themselves so they could see what she could see what size, and it worked much better if they didn't have tops on, and so this perpetrator got all these pictures of the kids. So it's, you know, really important to tell your kids you can't watch them 24 hours a day. And you say, you know, don't send pictures on the internet. If you don't want mom and dad to see the pictures, then don't take the pictures. If you don't want your grandmother to see the pictures, then don't take the pictures, because they will end up places. And it's really sharing stories with them about how these things can go horribly wrong. And it's not using scare tactics, but it's open communication. So I am the chair of the board of an organization called Zero Abuse Project. And we work very closely. We have an ICAC team, which is Internet Crimes Against Children, work very closely with the federal government in creating tools that allow police departments to triage reports of online child sexual abuse materials. And Zero Abuse Project played a big role in helping the Senate formulate their questions in that hearing with social media companies late January. Because, I mean, the technology is moving at such a fast pace that even the biggest experts can barely keep up. I mean, you think about it, Mark Zuckerberg, when he said, oh, I want to make a thing where I can see everyone's faces in college, probably did not extrapolate that he would be sitting in front of the Senate having to apologize for the fact that children are being exploited and sucked into you know, child sex abuse material online. I mean, it's a law of unintended consequences. So it's really about staying informed, monitoring your kids' technology, all your technology, video games, computers. I mean, and every appliance is smart now. So it's really a vigilant, and the most important thing you can do is keep open communication with your children. Because the more you talk about it in a way that's casual, comforting, and friendly, the more likely your child will be able to listen.
Yes, in fact, you know, I was just thinking about, you know, how AI and, you know, obviously I'm not up on all the different things that perpetrators could be doing, but I think, you know, AI could be a great contributor for people who are on that perpetrator side, because, you know, you could, you know, be programming. This is just my thoughts. You could be programming, you know, the AI to be reaching out to, you know, maybe millions of children at once. So not knowing, I guess how to tell if something's real, not real. So parents really, I think, have their work cut out for them. You would just suggest parents just stay on top of all technology as much as they can, or how do we start to deal with these things that are like, just, you know, I feel like they pop up like every month or something new.
Well, you know, for example, you know, and this is my opinion, but I don't think kids should have smartphones in elementary or middle school. If you ask my son, I was the meanest mom in the whole world. And he had a flip phone, a burner phone, basically. He's like, Mom, I look like a drug dealer. I'm like, that means it's cool, you know? Because
that's funny.
He didn't need the world in the palm of his hand when I wasn't around. He needed something that he could call mom if he needed a ride home. And so, you know, he ended up getting a smartphone because high school, especially because he was freshman year during COVID, it became so online based that it just made sense. But he'd already had good habits instilled in him, and he'd seen the disaster that happened to other people who got smartphones earlier. There's always monitoring software out there, but no monitoring software is going to monitor everything. Easy things you can do is make sure that phones are not in bedrooms overnight. If you have someone under, 17, 18, be like, hey, we charge our phones downstairs all night long. They're not in your room. You need an alarm, I'll buy you an alarm. And that's an easy way to solve a lot of problems. And if your kid wants to text with their friends or Snapchat with them or Discord or whatever, medium they're using, they have to do it, downstairs at night. And then that gives you some sense of an idea. And that's helpful. But when it comes to online usage, we have kids with Chromebooks that stay at school. The Chromebook has some decent monitoring things through the school, but not all schools use them. It will come down to open communication, understanding where your kid is in their peer group, checking in with them as much as possible, and making sure that they only get things at an age-appropriate time. So, it's a big haul. But a lot of the work is done when the kid is smaller. If you have strong boundaries and the kids understand the rules and they understand consequences and they understand rewards and you stick to those, it should be easier. But but parents have their work cut out for them. But I think that parents have always had their work cut out for them. And parenting is the most amazing experience that anyone can go through, and it's well worth the work. And, I didn't know my heart was capable of this kind of love, and I didn't know my hands were capable of this kind of work, but I'm willing to do every bit of it.
Yes, I like that parents should be involved. And so I think that's, one of the things, I guess, how we got here, right? This disconnection and hiding behind our machines, our tablets and everything like that. Everybody, of course, is, up in arms and concerned, but number one is getting back to that human connection and really knowing what your children are doing and not just, send them a text, because I've seen that in households. Everybody texts everything and you're like, they're just downstairs. I just send up a text. Getting back into that, conversation and, looking at each other in the eyes, very important. If someone does, unfortunately, get into a situation and ends up a victim of sexual abuse, one of the things, of course, some people may, of course, have the strength to say something, or some cases, a lot of people, due to feeling shame and a plethora of other things, never share that until maybe years later or never at all. But one of the things that I think, of course, is so remarkable about you is that you moved out of a space of, feeling, victimization or self-blame. And so how does someone develop the mental strength that you had, or, the ability to look at it differently? Like, how do you do that, I guess?
Well, first, let's, scroll back a little bit and remember that it's it's very rare for survivors to come forward as they're being abused. In fact, the average disclosure age for men is like 54 before they will say anything to anyone about it. There's so much shame involved. For women, it's usually in their 30s. I knew that what happened to me was wrong, but I thought I was the wrongdoer for a long time. The story that I told myself and that people told me was that I seduced the teacher. And if you look at pictures of me in that era, I look like a little boy. And no matter how you see it, you know, he went on to abuse other girls as well. There's like no way. And I'm not going to lie. I still grapple with self-blame a lot. And there is a little bit of shame involved. But that's, you know, it's a trial we all have to go through. No one is ever, you know, completely cured from the whole thing. But really, it comes down to, for me, I think what really helped me the most was looking at kids who were the age I was when I was abused. When we think of ourselves, when I think of myself at 12 or 15, I thought I was invincible. I know more than the adults. They're a bunch of adults. They don't understand. I know everything. But when I, as an adult, look at a bunch of 12-year-olds or 15-year-olds, I see them for the dopes that they are. They're dorky and they're naive and they don't know what's going on and they're easily manipulated by the adults in their life. And that was very eye-opening for me because I looked at, and I had some movies and stuff too of me at that age, and I'm like, oh my God, how could that baby, that child, ever be responsible for the sexual abuse by a man who was significantly older than she was? And so that was a big help. And it's really a lot of therapy. And there's different, it doesn't have to be talk therapy. There's EMDR, which is eye movement I forget what it stands for. But basically, they use therapy and eye movements, and it's been proven to help lessen the effects of PTSD. I have been, you know, I was one of the first, you know, the first generation on antidepressants, very low dose, but it was extraordinarily helpful for me. And it's about finding a community and finding that community who is the first to say, what happened to you was not your fault. What happened to you was a crime and you didn't deserve it. And so I think that's what's been able to really lift me up through all this. And I think I carry around a pretty decent helping of moral indignation. I hate it when people lie to me. Man, they lie to me. I hate it. And so I realize that life isn't fair, but life should be just. And as such, I will fight to make sure that liars, cheats, thieves, and abusers don't get away with anything. Because it gets my dander up. So all those things together have been how I've done it. For a lot of other people, it's through a journey into spirituality. I am new to that spiritual journey. It's only been in the past like 6 or 8 months that I've even decided to look into that route, because my moral indignation was carrying me all this other time. So, you know, spirituality, community, and really just loving the little you that was so horribly hurt. I mean, 15-year-old Joelle was in a world of hurt, and it's my job to love her and nurture her, because 53-year-old Joelle knows that everything is going to turn out okay and that 15-year-old Joelle is a worthwhile person. So it's a lot of work, and it really has nothing to do with strength. It has nothing to do with tenacity. It just has to do with where you are in your journey, because everybody's journey is different, and the effects of the abuse on everyone is different. And so when we honor that, then we give survivors the means by which to come to healing on their own terms and on their own timeline.
You said so many things that I think a lot of people need to hear when they're in that situation. It's finding people that don't shame you or blame you, but are able to, you know, lift you up. And then also it's that self-acceptance of being like, okay, what happened to me wasn't my fault. It happened, but I can move forward. And then having the ability to know that it's not going to, you know, heal overnight. Because I think, you know, everybody wants everything. And, you know, that's just, I think, human nature. Everybody wants, if there's a problem, let's just make it go away. And just understand that, yes, there, you know, there will be probably always a little bit of something, but that it will hopefully lessen over time by being able to expose it to yourself, to face it. Because I think that's probably what, in you know, a lot of problems, when people don't want to face it, then it tends to, you know, run over and, you know, turn out in other ways that we didn't expect. So one of the other things is that, of course, you've written a number of books. And so if you had to pick, either it can be, I guess, your favorite book or the book that you think that every parent or person should read, which one of your books would you suggest?
Well, gosh, that's a tough one because, you know, I think my best book is The Well-Armored Child, but it has a fatal flaw. It's big. And so parents look at that and they're like, I'm not reading that whole book. And what you don't see in the cover is that it's very age specific. All you have to do is read the chapter where you're at. You don't have to sit and read the whole thing. But the book that surprised me the most is The Compassionate Response. And The Compassionate Response started as a chapter of The Well-Armored Child. And the editor's like, this doesn't have a place here. And so I put it out as a free ebook. And man, that sucker goes like hotcakes. Because nobody, and I didn't, and I, the reason I wrote it is because I knew this myself. Nobody tells you what to do or say when someone comes to you and says, I was sexually abused as a child. And so, you know, when someone tells us that, we just stand there like a dope. And that's not what the survivor needs or wants. And so they're just like, it's a short book. It's like 10 or 12 pages. And it has resources and things to say and how to draw boundaries, because a lot of times, like if you have a helper personality, you'll try to help too much and it might hurt the survivor's boundaries or it might hurt your boundaries. So it's a really sweet, simple little book, and it's free. You can get it on my website, castex.com. And that has been very effective. And then for parents, you know, The Well-Armored Child, just don't be discouraged by the length and just go to the chapter where you're at right now. If you have a preschooler, read the preschooler chapter. Don't worry about the rest. So...
Yes, I actually did. I read your ebook, and yes, it was something actually that one of the things that did interest me about that book is that, yes, I wasn't, I've never thought about like, what do you say if somebody comes to you and say they've been sexually abused, right? Because normally I'd be like a deer in headlights, but it was so straightforward and it was practical applications, and it made you the person who, you know, they may come to not freak out and yeah. Have, you know, real steps that you didn't feel like, you know, overwhelmed. So I think that's extremely important because that's the thing. This is just from my personal experience, not necessarily about sexual abuse, but I find that when people are confronted to deal with like big life situations, the people who are actually not dealing with it are the ones that end up freaking out most.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. which I always think is like, but this is not happening to you, right? But they take it on and they're like, oh, I can't handle it. And you're like, but it's happening to me. So I think that was that's a perfect. Book, and it was a quick read, and I found it very informative. And so one of the other things I wanted to talk to about is for people that, you know, since we just talked about people being approached that to be told like somebody had been sexually abused, what are some of the signs and symptoms, I guess, that we can look for in our child? Because maybe we don't have, you know, we haven't built that closeness, or we see, you know, we might feel like, okay, what's going on with our child, or, you know, or that niece or nephew? What are some signs and symptoms that we should start to look out for that something's not right, that your child may be getting sexually abused?
Well, every kid is different. And every kid manifests these signs and symptoms at a different time. And so, you mean, there's not going to be like some kind of red flag. They're like, oh my gosh, my child's being sexually abused. But there are things that you can look for, and you can look for them before the abuse even starts. And that is understanding the signs and symptoms of predatory grooming. Because if you understand, and I mean, I could go into it here, but it would take hours. I mean, look online about the signs of grooming. If there is an adult in your world who is spending inappropriate amounts of time with kids, who's isolating particular kids, who's giving them gifts, who's flattering them, who the kids, you know, flock and gather around, who tells kids secrets, who breaks the rules with kids, someone who may be giving boys access to pornography or teenagers access to drugs and alcohol, someone who you think is taking an unhealthy interest in your child. That's the stuff to really, really look out for. And then if your kid is being sexually abused, you may or may not know for a long, long time. You may have a niggling suspicion in the back of your head that something happened, but you won't be able to put your finger on it. But there are some things that you can see, especially in younger children, overly sexualized children, children who are way too overly sexualized for their age, children who act out and begin self-harm. But see, that can be the symptom of many different things that a parent needs to get to the bottom of. But if your child is cutting or hurting themselves or engaging in self-destructive behavior or, you know, showing signs of addiction to drugs and alcohol, using drugs and alcohol at a young age, these can all be signs and symptoms. But if you take that together with understanding the signs and symptoms of grooming and keeping communication open with your kid, I think those are the best ways that you can really either A, see if they're being groomed for abuse, or B, see if they've already been abused.
Now I have the last question. This is I always call the pageant question. So, because I want to bring, child sexual abuse to everybody's kind of front door and understanding. So as a society, even if we personally in our lives haven't or don't know someone who has been sexually abused, why worldwide should we care, I guess, or how is this affecting our society on a different level than, of course, just, of course, the physical damage, if we were going to go to the next level?
I believe that the single most detrimental thing that can happen to our society is when a child is sexually abused. Why is this? If you were to take a survey, and this actually has been done, I don't have the statistics in front of me, of men in the federal penitentiary system, something like 90% of them were sexually abused as children. If you look at kids in sex trafficking and even adults in sex trafficking, most of them were introduced to the life because of child sexual abuse. The problems that stem from child sexual abuse as that survivor gets older include domestic violence, drug and alcohol abuse, jail, criminal activity. Plus, they're far more inclined, according to the Kaiser Health Foundation, of dying from preventable diseases such as heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. So it's devastating on our society, and it's cyclical, because the less we talk about it, the more it occurs. And so that's why it's important, because I personally believe that if we eradicate child sexual abuse, we will eradicate 80% of the problems we have in our criminal justice system as well.
Yes, fantastic. Thank you, Joelle, for your time and insight. To learn more about Joelle and her books, go to castex.com. If you have a passion for an unserved community, a social justice problem, or simply want to change minds, contact Project Good Work at projectgood.org to start your project of change today. It's that time again. The Changemaker Conference is happening September 12, 2024. Register now at changemakerconference.com. Subscribe to our mailing list at projectgood.org/subscribe to get our episodes and blog articles sent to you each month, Plus, get a 10% discount on any project you start with on projectgood.org. To our listeners, thanks for tuning in to Project Good, where we're focused on what matters.